Hi everyone, welcome back to the Topcast. We've got a great interview for you today with the wonderful Will Bailey. Now, I found out about Will some time ago, a number of years ago, when I was working with Deborah Perez, who created a great group teaching and ensemble playing course for the teachers in our Top Music Pro membership. It's been really popular, and Deborah is a fantastic presenter and incredible teacher. And when she talked about Will and all the great things that they were doing together in creating their Way Cool keyboarding series, their method, their approach for teaching in groups, he came to mind when I was looking at our interviews for this year, and I thought I'd really like to meet Will and find out a bit more about him and how he's come to be doing what he's doing. And I think this interview will be really instructive because Will talks about his revelation, I guess, after some 25 years of a very classical approach to teaching. He had this moment in time when he just realized that what he was doing perhaps wasn't actually having the outcomes and the benefits and the effects that he wanted to give his students. And so he completely pivoted. And for the last 20 years, he's been experimenting with recreational music making philosophies and student-led learning. And it's been having an incredible impact on both him as a teacher and the way he feels about what he's doing, and also on the students with whom he works every week. Will Bailey is a piano teacher and composer, and he's been teaching piano privately and in groups for over 45 years. He holds degrees in elementary education, music theory and composition, and piano performance and pedagogy. Indeed, he actually is a Dr. Bailey, but he wasn't too keen for me to call him doctor on this interview. He's currently working with Deborah Perez, creating group teaching materials for students of all ages. Well, let's welcome into the show, Will Bailey.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we could make it work. You and I, we've connected for a little while over email because I first found out about you through Deborah Perez, who I met at conferences years and years ago, and then she did some work for us. She created a course for us, and she introduced me to the Way Cool series of group teaching books that you two worked on and which I've been happily recommending to teachers. So before we get into what you're working on today, I'd be fascinated to know let's cover what are you doing today? What's a week in the life of Will Bailey?
Oh yeah, well it's crazy kind of. I teach adult classes here. I have five adult classes that I teach, all recreational music making classes, and then I have some private students that I teach here, and then I have online students that I teach. But when Deborah and I work together, we work on, like this week, we've been working on Adventures of Way Cool Kitty, which is our kindergarten program. We have two semesters of kindergarten that we're working on right now. And we also worked on Piano Band 3. We have two Piano Band books, 1 and 2, that go with Way Cool Kids 1 and 2. And Piano Band 3 is going to cover everything in the Teens Way Cool books 1 and 2. And so it's like ensemble and band experiences with like five or six parts so that all different levels of kids who are playing together can enjoy playing rock and roll and dance music and stuff like that.
It's fantastic. One of the things I really loved about the Way Cool books were your backing tracks and the accompaniments and things. They were really that really engaging kind of pop style. Some of them sounded, you know, that you had funk and rock and maybe even worshipy kind of sounds in some of them. Like there was a whole range of different styles. But what I really loved, I can particularly remember using, I don't teach groups, but I used your books on a one-on-one lesson with a teenage boy who was really disconnected, really, really struggling. But what I could get him to do is read one hand, because a lot of the music in that book, you can just read one hand and played chords in the left hand and he played along to the backing tracks. It was quite simple, but he got the reading happening, and the engaging part was the sounds that he were making were really cool because you use lots of fifths and kind of sounds like power chords, and that's what I really loved about that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you say here, where are you? Where's your studio? Is it your own place at home or what do you do? I also note you're wearing a Yamaha shirt too.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yamaha. Yeah. actually, I'm here at the store in Corpus Christi. My wife and I have relocated here and we live on the island, which is just across about 15 miles from here. And I've been working here with Deborah for about 2 years now.
Excuse my ignorance. Where is Corpus Christi? What state?
It's in Texas. It's in Texas.
Okay, great.
Yeah, on the Gulf Coast.
All right, and this isn't Deborah. Deborah has a separate studio. Is that right?
Well, Deborah, she has two stores. She has one store here in Corpus, and then she has another store in McAllen, Texas, which is about 2.5 hours from here, right on the Mexican border.
Ah, got so, it. Okay.
Goes back and forth between the two stores.
Fantastic. Oh, that's great. Great to hear that you're doing so much teaching too. And I want to unpack shortly some of the changes that have happened in your teaching over your career, because it sounds like you completely flipped and pivoted at one stage. And I want to dive into that in a minute. But take us back firstly, what was your own musical training? I assume it was on piano. What was it like?
Well, I started playing before I ever had lessons. So I started playing by ear when I was, you know, maybe 11 or 12 years old. Started playing for church when I was 12. Started playing in a band when I was like 13. I accompanied my wife for she wasn't my wife then, but my girlfriend. And she, I remember she said, "You've got a friend," and won this talent show. And one of the local piano teachers, who was really quite a great piano teacher, he was there at that performance because his wife was a public school teacher, and heard me play and called my parents and said, "You know, I'd like to set up an interview. Maybe you'd like to take some lessons." And that's when I started taking lessons. And this guy loved music. I mean, he loved music. And he also met me where I was. I wasn't going to be playing people on the bus go round and round. It's not my thing. I wasn't going to do that. And first pieces that I learned, he sent me home with recordings and scores, and I did Bach inventions. I think it was Switched on Bach had just come out, so that was really impressive to me. And so I learned Bach inventions and Mussorgsky pictures in an exhibition, because that was really appealing to me, and then started playing concertos and did classical music then until I graduated from high school.
Oh my goodness. So wait, what age were you when you had your first formal lesson?
I had just turned 15.
Wow. But you'd been playing for eight
since I was
or more years.
Years.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So 4 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I must say, I really appreciate the approach your teacher took to, you said, met you where you were at. I think this is so fundamental, because I actually came back to classical piano performance after a significant break of doing what you were doing, accompanying friends, playing for church services, all that kind of stuff. And I knew my technique wasn't going to be the same as a conservatory level person. And I was having lessons with an incredible concert performer. But we found that she was just really happy to pick up where I was at and work with me, because I'd had another approach where I'd gone to play for someone else and they were like, "All right, well, we've got to start from scratch here. 2 years of scales." And it's just like, what? Who is going to do that?
We're going to break you down and rebuild you.
Right. And in the process, I'm going to give up. So I think that is such an important approach for us now as teachers, to be going, okay, well, look, maybe this student who's perhaps transferred to us, maybe their technique isn't so good. We can work with it. And it's not all about getting those fundamentals right. It's great to do that, but it's the engagement and the connection. And they're the things that will keep the student playing. We can work on the technique as we go. So it's great to have a similar focus.
You can't teach an empty bench.
No, that's so right.
If you run a kid off because you need it to go your way, then you've lost. You lost the battle. So
so you got stuck into all this classical repertoire from the age of 15. By the time a few years had gone past, you were playing concertos. So this is quite serious classical. And then when you started teaching, what kind of age were you, and how did you teach when you first started?
I actually started teaching the very month that I started taking.
Okay.
Because my parents couldn't afford piano lessons. And so I took on two kids from church who heard me play and thought I could really play. And so I started teaching them, and my teacher gave me a few things that I could get them started with. So I started teaching the way he told me to teach, and then I started learning that I didn't know anything. I still don't know much.
We all do that, don't we, when we start? So it sounds like his teaching of you was fairly traditional, particularly given the composers you've just mentioned. Was that a fair statement? It was quite classical, and therefore you were teaching in the same way?
I was teaching the same way, yeah.
Right.
But what you've told me in some of our email communications is that something changed maybe 20 years ago. I think it was about then. And I want to know what changed in your thinking, because it sounds like you were teaching one certain way for quite a few years, maybe even a decade or more, and then something changed. So can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, I there were a lot of things. Like not one thing ever just changes. I mean, I think that when you're teaching a lot of students, my wife and I had six kids before we were 24.
Oh, my goodness.
So I had to teach a lot of students, lot of students. And, you know, like between, you know, 75 and 90 kids every week and sometimes more, just to pay the bills. And it was tough. And I remember one night leaving just being exhausted and thinking that my teacher used to say, I've got five good students, the rest are all bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about that, and I started thinking, you know, that's nonsense. That's why I'm so tired. The reason I'm so tired is because I'm not making this accessible and fun for every student who comes in. He met me where I was because he knew I'd do what he wanted me to do, but he didn't meet everybody where they were. He tried to create something from them that they just didn't want. Maybe they didn't have the wherewithal to do it, but probably they just didn't want it. And so I started making the switch and saying, you know, what if I just don't talk about how much they're playing at home?
Mm.
What if I just stop talking about that completely? What if every time they walk in the door, they're a clean slate, and we're going to have a really fun musical experience, and we're going to do something that when they leave, they're happy, and I'm happy, and they've learned something. And that it started changing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Then Deborah started talking to me about recreational music making. She had met Carl Brune, who was like the godfather of, maybe the grandfather, the godfather's terrible, of recreational music making. And I thought, man, this really resonates with me. There are thousands of people who want to learn to play the piano for their own enjoyment. They just want to have fun and make music. And we're not making it possible for them because we already have decided what that means. Mm. What learning to play. We've decided what proficiency level they have to be at. We've decided that it has to be 90% accurate. What do you mean that kid can't play that to tempo? I mean, what if we let go of all of that and let people make music and just have fun with it? So that's kind of how that journey went.
There may be people listening who don't know what recreational music making refers to. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I'll try to. Deborah used to call it hobbyists. She used to work with adult hobbyists, people who were just having fun playing the piano.
Isn't that what we all should be doing?
Yeah, right?
That's what I've always found so silly about this concept of hobby. It's like, we're all here to have fun, aren't we? That we want our kids to have fun. Why is it not fun?
Well, somebody told me once that the real definition of amateur is for the love of it.
Mm.
Well, we should all be amateurs then, right? We should all be doing this for the love of it.
Yeah,
and so that movement was mainly for adults, and they got together in all different venues to make music together. And Deborah and I actually started writing for adult hobbyists or recreational music makers who are adults in groups. But I think that what it does is it addresses this huge number of people that don't fit into what we call traditional. They want to play music they love. They might only have one song. I have a guy who's a prime example, Henry, who comes on Wednesday mornings. He's 61 years old and he's just a kid. And he wanted to play one song. He wanted to play, what's the Henry Nielsen song? I Can't Live If Living Is Without You.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to play it in the original key because he can sing it in that key. And if he could play that one song, play the chorus of that one song and sing that, his whole life would be fulfilled. And so he's going into his second year now, about 2 months into his second year. And he's got about 10 songs that he can play and sing to. And he's as happy as he can be. All he does is play chords and sing. doesn't want to know anything about the staff. He's got inversions down. Man, that guy can name inversions to chords like that fast. And he can read chord charts. He doesn't want to read the staff. Not going to ever read the staff probably, but it doesn't matter because he doesn't need to. Mm. And he's having a blast. Plus, he's purchased a couple really nice keyboards.
So I mean, this aligns so well with everything that I believe, everything that Top Music stands for, everything that I teach teachers to. And you mentioned in one of our emails, I might just quote this because I think you summarize it beautifully. And you said, when the main teaching objective is for students to love music and make it part of their lives, everything from pedagogical strategy to assessment is pretty much turned on its head. And I think this is so true, but it can be really quite scary for teachers who aren't used to this. So I wonder how you go about working with teachers, or what advice you would have for teachers who aren't really sure about this whole just turning everything upside down and going with the flow of the student.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I talked to a teacher here years ago at the store, and she had come in one of the courses that she was used to buying. She was teaching college students, and the course that she had been using for her piano class there was discontinued. And so my first question, of course, have you had good success with this course? And her response was, well, no, not really. None of the students can really play by the time we're done with the semester. And I said, well, have you ever considered looking at another course? And she said, absolutely not. I know how to teach this course.
Yeah.
And I think that's where teachers find themselves. They find themselves, I've always taught this way. I've always turned this page. And if that wasn't there, I see blogs. What are you supposed to do if they don't show up without their books? What?
Yeah, right. Well, it's quite funny. As we're recording this, we are right in the middle of a 5-day challenge that we're running with a whole lot of people, teachers, on off-page teaching strategies, what to do, how to do it. And each day we're giving them a new idea about what to do. Because I've heard those stories, Will, of teachers who will put a message in a Facebook group or something saying, oh, what do you do with students who don't bring their books? And they're like, I force them to sight read for 30 minutes and they do scales for an hour. And it's like, oh my, really? Guys, come on.
And they come back. And why did they come back?
Torture me some more. I mean, we have to be, if nothing else these days, we've got to be flexible and we have to give the students some autonomy in what they do. It's just so crucial. I think teachers listening may have a question for you, though, about whether this approach is applicable to young children as it is for adults. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. I'll just give you an example of one of my little six-year-olds that I have. And she's, of course, we started in the Way Cool Kids book, you know, but the books, the Way Cool Kids and the Way Cool Teens book, they're like springboards. They're just to get some sounds in kids' ears, to get their fingers moving, to give them some ideas. And her name is Daphne, and Daphne calls me Mr. Will. So I get these texts from her mom because I have three of the older kids, too, as students. And the mom sends me texts. Daphne really wants to learn In Christ Alone. She really loves that song. She really wants to learn that. And I said, well, no problem. We'll do it. And so we get to her lesson, and I said, Daphne, can you sing that? She goes, yeah. And so she sings the first part of it, and we learn the first part of it by rote. And I said, next week we'll learn the second part. Oh, no, Mr. Will, we're going to learn it tonight. Okay, we'll do the next part too then. And she gets all the way through it, and we play a few things in her book, and she's just happy as a bird. And her mom texts me back. She is so happy that she got to learn that song. Well, that didn't hurt anything. It's great ear development. It's good. I mean, she's got to figure out how to use her ears too. It's not just all about what's on the page. We can do everything from singing it first and then playing it. with her, because she can sing, she's already figured out how to match that to the keyboard. We just made huge progress with that lesson. I feel like that's wonderful, where she's going to be a great little piano player. But yeah, you can use that at all levels.
Mm.
I get texts and messages all the time. You know, Maddox wants to learn so-and-so. Do you think he can learn that? Of course. You know, do they have to learn the whole thing? No. Do they? I mean, if they learn 8 measures of it and then go, you know, I really want to learn something else. Okay, let's learn something else. You know, some people say, well, that's like squirrel. Let's go over. But how much do you learn from a book if you just read a passage from a book and ponder it? And then should you not have read that? You know, I think we get a lot of benefit out of trying a lot of different things.
Mm.
And do you have to have like a particular course? I think you have to know where all your kids are. Do you know what their technical limitations are? Of course you do. You know, do they have to warm up with 5-finger scales? Well, yeah, those are games. Hey, can you do this? Yeah, can you do this? Hey, can you do them backwards? Can you do them together? You know, you have to get technique, and theory is really just mechanics of music. Just what they need for that particular lesson. Just create a quick game that fits for that and teach that way. I mean, I think it is scary though, because it doesn't fit with, did they do their theory lesson in their theory book? Did they do their repertoire song? Did they, you know?
Yeah. And another challenge as well is not finishing pieces to a recital, in inverted commas, like the performance standard, because the last 200 years of music education in instrumental music has been about performing a recital, probably without music and memorized, and it's got to be hard music and you got to play it faultlessly. And so breaking that paradigm is a challenge too in teachers' heads, that it's okay to explore a lot of different things and not necessarily finish. I mean, you should, of course, it's a great challenge for students to finish and play something brilliantly and be really confident with it and learn it over time. But if that's all you're doing, then that is where the challenge comes. And I think that's what I hear from you. It's about being flexible and saying, yeah, we've got to do some scales, but let's make it fun. We need to make sure we do our theory, but we're going to learn the theory by learning about the chords and the harmony of the pieces and things like that. You're going to learn some pieces from the books, and you use your Way Cool books. Others might use their method or whatever it is, but you're supplementing the whole time. What would you like to learn? Let's do that. Let's try it. I don't even know what that piece is, but I'm going to give it a shot.
Right.
Is that a good summary of your approach?
Yes, it is. In fact, the first thing I say at the beginning of every online lesson is, what are we going to do today? Because they need to decide what we're going to do. And when I leave them, hey, are you cool with what we're doing right now? Do you want to continue this, or is there another piece you'd like to look at? And it's just to always be taking temperature, making sure that we're on target for them directing. When I have parents who contact me and say, I want my child to do this regimen, I want them to be ready for these tests at this time, this is what I want for them. I always ask if that's what the student is interested in, or if that's what they're interested in. And if they can't respond that their child is interested in that, it's being parent driven, then I just tell them that I'm the wrong teacher, because I don't want to do that anymore. I mean, I did that for a long time, and my kids did well in auditions, and I just patted myself on the back. I was such a good teacher because they did so good, but it was really about me, wasn't it? Yeah. And that's what really good playing at recitals is about. A lot of times it becomes about the teacher getting, I think it's about validation. We piano teachers have a hard job because they do their job in isolation and they need validation. I do understand that. I'm really sympathetic to that. But the validation should come to us from a kid leaving their lesson saying, I can't wait to get home to try this out. I'm so excited about learning this piece. That's where it should come.
Yeah. And the parents texting you midway through the week saying, what are you doing? Because I can't get Johnny off the piano. He is going crazy with this faith. I mean, I really get validation from, yes, the student, but also the parent, the comments from the parents. Yeah. Oh, he's playing more than he ever used to. And I've told stories about students who have, particularly around that transition from elementary to high school, have really fallen off the practice thing. And that's so often when teachers will go, well, you know, Sarah's not been practicing for a month. I'm not wasting my time anymore. I'm not going to waste your money anymore. That's it. We're done. And it's such a sad situation, because I've proven time and time again that if you just take away that practice burden, as you sounds like you do, and don't ask, don't make your first question, so how much practice did you do this week? For God's sake, please don't do that. If you take away that pressure, suddenly the enjoyment comes back.
Yeah, I don't even like that word. I mean, I use the word play just because I think play is so much more fun.
Yeah. Play is what everyone wants to do. Playtime at school. That's the fun time, right?
Play is the fun time, right? Matt here, Deborah's husband, always says when people leave class, he always says, play what you love and love what you play. That's the assignment for the week.
Yeah.
And I that's awesome.
You mentioned in some of our correspondence a pedagogical strategy that you use, and you listed four things, which I can either go through, or you may know them off the top of your head, the tools that your students need to play the music they love, according to Will Bailey. Can you remember what the four were?
I don't.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, so I'm guessing, is this a test?
Yes, a test. No, it's not a test. So you said for you there are four key things: to decipher the staff.
Right.
To read a chord chart.
Yep.
To play a melody by ear and to know how chord progressions work.
Yeah.
Would that be a fairly good summary of what you find is important?
It is, but I don't think that all students need all four of those things, depending on what they want. If I'm talking about a kid who I'm working with, you know, yes. An adult, not so much.
Right. And that's what you were saying in regard to the staff teaching, note reading. If they're 60 or 70, in fact, even if they're a teenager, do we really have to force note reading on kids? I don't know.
I think it's okay that they know what it is. I think it's okay that they can identify it, but I didn't learn to read the staff in a traditional way because I was jumping into great big literature. So I wasn't really sight reading much of anything. I was just, between learning by ear and doing a measure at a time, I was just compiling lots of musical information into these huge chunks. So I didn't do it the traditional way, and I still don't probably read traditionally. When I look at the staff now, I hear what it's going to sound like before I play it. So I don't really think I'm sight reading. I think I'm still playing by ear, but I've done enough repetitions of enough music that when I see it, I hear it already. Mm. I know what the pattern is and I can hear it in my head. So I'm not, the first time I play it isn't the first time I've heard it. I've heard it already before I played it. So I don't think everybody does that the same. And I don't think we should put everybody in a box and say, this is how, I mean, there are people that read the staff. I have a friend, I played Rachmaninoff, the Tarantella Rachmaninoff, the big duet with her, she can sight read that. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, my teacher could sight read anything.
Just amazing. It's like, oh no, I'm going to play through that four times and I'm going to have it memorized. That's too much to look at. But I respect that, but that's, I don't think everybody is the same, and I don't think we should expect every student to be the same.
Mm. We've mentioned assessment just a couple of times. I just want to come back to that as well, because one of the challenges, I guess, of having a more free and flexible approach to teaching is that there isn't that assessment at the end where the student plays at a recital necessarily. So do you have other measures? We've kind of talked about one in regards to the student's own feedback. Are there any other measures that you use to kind of assess where students are going?
You know, most of my assessment is I want them to play well. So they don't have to play perfectly, but they need to play well. they know if they play well, right? So I want them to play as well as they want to play. And if they're happy with the way they're playing, then I'm happy to accept their level of proficiency. If they feel fulfilled in the way they're playing, and I mean, I've had adults in class, I played some simple little thing out of one of the Musical Moments books to introduce it to a class. And I've had them say, if that's the only thing I'm ever able to play, I can die happy.
Mm.
Well, if they learn to play that, then they, who am I to say?
They've achieved their goal. Mm.
That's right. I don't have this careful checklist of things. I think every single student has a different assessment. If they're happy and they're going to come back next week and they're going to try again and they have a new tune that they want to learn, then all of that will change. From lesson to lesson, it'll change. The assessment will change.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about the composing side of what you do, because you're obviously a phenomenal teacher, but you also do a lot of composing. How did you get into that?
I'm mostly a functional composer.
What does that mean?
it serves a purpose. I'm not trying to make a career on composing. Everything that I write serves a pedagogical function. And so hopefully it has some sort of interest in it that will grab a kid's attention, but has some sort of technical or theoretical or step-to-step motion, progressive-wise. But it's not like, I started actually in 94. Have you ever heard of Margaret Goldston?
Yeah, I was talking to her son, Christopher, the other day.
Yeah, well, years ago, in 94, in fact, maybe it was 93 when I met her. I was her assistant in a town that I lived in while she was doing a showcase of her music. And I played all the second piano stuff for her. And I just was intrigued with her. And I thought she was just the neatest lady in the world. And she was just very kind and wonderful. But when she left, I thought, you know, I should write some stuff because I think I would like doing that. And so I did. I wrote a book called Postcards from the Old West, because that's where we lived, in the Old West, and sent it to Alfred. And Gail Kowalczyk called, and they actually published it and published several things that I had written. But I hadn't gone to school to do graduate work in music. I had a degree in elementary education. So I decided to go to school. That's what sent me to school, because I thought, man, there's a lot of stuff I don't know. I don't even know how to beam this stuff. I don't know which way to put the slur marks or the ties. I mean, so I went and got a master's and doctorate in music theory and composition.
All right, you don't do things by halves, do you? Not just a master's, but a doctorate as well.
I needed to learn about this.
So you have a doctorate. So it's Dr. Bailey. I'm sorry, I should have introduced you differently.
Don't do that.
Wait, you have a doctorate.
Will is good. Nobody calls me Dr. Bailey. Nobody calls me Dr. Bailey.
Or Dr. Will. You've got a doctorate in music theory.
And composition, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. Okay.
Yeah, and I have secondary emphasis then in piano performance and pedagogy.
Wow. Really amazing. And are you enjoying the balance of today of the composition, the pedagogical composition you do, and the teaching?
Yes. I need to teach to write.
Right.
Because I have to be able to do Dance Monkey and Coffin Dance off the top of your head. Right. What's the other one? Electro Man? Have you done Electro Man from Geometry Dash? Oh, that must be an American thing.
Okay, no, I haven't.
Start.
Now you've got over your right shoulder, people who are listening can't see obviously, but you've got a table of sheet music. So you're obviously working on a whole lot of stuff at the moment. So tell us just give us a quick outline of the publications that you've put together.
Okay, well, the thing that Deborah and I are working on right now is we're working on a public school program that goes kindergarten through high school.
Oh, wow.
And so the kindergarten program is Adventures of Way Cool Kitty. And so that's hard stuff. I mean, I have certification in Orphan Kodai, but preschool and kindergarten is really hard. And this is a completely, you'll be happy about this, This is a completely no book, no staff, all by ear course for kindergarten.
As it should be. I mean, last thing you want to do is get them reading at that age. It's all about play and fun and experience and composing and creating.
And creating and having fun, yeah. So we're doing that for the kindergarten. We have, for K through five, we're using Wacol Keyboarding Kids 1 and 2. And we've created Piano Band 1 and 2, which is ensemble and group activities, band activities for the kids. And then, of course, Deborah's writing out the enrichment activities to go along with the games and off staff and off keyboard and off bench stuff.
Wow.
And then we're doing, then we have Wacol Keyboarding for high school, the books 1 and 2 for that. And then the Piano Band book 3 is what we're currently doing right now, that kind of does the whole scope of both books with band experiences. So
what a huge project. And the goal of this is mainly for school teachers with classrooms of musicians or music kids.
Yes. When what we have going on here in the States is we have general music classes are buying big piano labs. So instead of just singing and doing solfege in music class, they're teaching them to play the piano.
Oh, wow.
And so this, you know, as you know, Wacol Keyboarding would be a really good fit for that.
Perfect, yeah.
So that we're just making it fit for all these schools who are needing curriculum for that.
Amazing. Oh, that's great. Is it more common? Is this a big thing in Texas in particular? Or is this happening all over the States?
We have several things here going on here in Texas, and I know we have schools in California and Florida.
Right.
So I think the more progressive school systems are doing this, and they're finding really good success, and it gives people something to do with their hands, so they're not always punching each other.
Well, Will, it's been just so much fun hanging out with you. I'm so glad we finally met. As I say, I've used your resources for so long. I've known Deborah for ages. And she's always said, oh, you've got to meet Will. You're going to get on like a house on fire. And we have. So I really enjoyed connecting with you, Will. Where can people find out about these projects that you're working on and the books that you've got?
If they go to musicalmomentsrmm.com.
Great. MusicalMomentsRMM.com. We'll put a link in our show notes as well so people can find that.
Good. They can find all of it there.
Fantastic. Highly recommend the Wacol series, particularly for those, regardless if you're teaching groups or one-on-one, just for kids that just need a different approach and you don't want to go completely off book, you want to have a reference, I think it's a great approach. So well done on that. Congratulations and good luck with your big project.
Thank you. Thank you. We're excited.
All right.
It's wonderful to meet you. Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. It was great. See ya.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's chat with Will. I got so much value from it, and I really enjoyed connecting with him. He's just a magnificent human, incredible musician. And as you can tell, even after 45 years of teaching or whatever it was, he's still got so much energy and passion, and his table full of compositions and the method books that he's working on with Deborah, it's just extraordinary. Both how passionate but also prolific Will has been, and I know will continue to be, and I look forward to keeping in touch with him, and maybe we'll check in with him again in a few years to see what he's been up to. Now, the episode's over, but if you heard about an event or product or service or something and you didn't have a chance to write it down, then don't worry. We list everything you've heard about on the episode in our show notes. Just head over to topmusic.co/episode234. And next week on the podcast, drum roll, because we have the keynote speaker from this year's MTNA joining us. It is the incredible Angela Miles Beeching. You are going to be blown away by next week's episode. I look forward to joining you then. I'm Tim Topham, and you've been listening to the Topcast from topmusic.co. I'll speak to you next time. Bye-bye. For more information about this episode and to find out how to enhance your own teaching, visit topmusic.co. You'll find everything you need for your studio, from lesson plans to cheat sheets, quick win teaching ideas, and guides on how to build your teaching business. Plus, you'll be connected to a global community of the world's top music teachers. And when you're ready, join hundreds of other teachers around the world by becoming a Top Music Pro member and get access to all our bonus content and flagship courses. And don't forget to follow topmusic.co on social media and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. That's all for today. We'll see you in the studio.